Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, have you ever been seriously disrupted, annoyed or inconvenienced by a protest in your local area?
I think I'm generally more likely to be the person causing the annoyance.
That has been my experience, to be honest.
Then that's rude. Every 2 weeks I just come in here and I annoy you. Does this count as a protest? Are my rights of freedom of speech going to be curtailed by new government regulations?
That would be nice. I would love to write to the police and dob you in.
Don't lie to me. You'd miss me.
Maybe for a bit. We are, of course, referencing a bill that is currently going through Parliament that seeks to restrict protest in various ways. One of the ways is that if your protest is annoying people too much, the police can just stop it, basically.
Mm-hmm. And some people... Annoyance and noise, isn't it?
Annoyance, noise, inconvenience, disturbance, disruption, all of the bad things.
Kind of takes away the point of it, doesn't it? Anyway.
Some people would argue. We should say, actually, we should introduce our special guest, Nick Matsey, who has been on the podcast before. Nick, do you want to say hi, let the people know you're here?
Hello, yes.
You were a big fan of protesting in the Brexit era, when
I have
we
always
had actually left.
Believed in protest.
Excellent. Which is somewhat, like, some may be surprised by that, because you're a bit of a straight-laced lad, aren't you? Ex-army boy.
I would say I used to think it was odd, the extent to which people protest. I suppose as I matured and left the army a few years ago. Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of people, my comrades in arms, would probably say, why on earth do we allow all these people to protest? So it's not a common view from my background experience, mm-hmm. I have to say.
Nick, what is your for anybody who hasn't heard previous episodes where you have guested for us, what's your background? Give us your credentials.
Yes, sure. So I was an army officer for 9 years. I joined in 2006. Did some time in Afghanistan and Kosovo and Northern Ireland. So I got to know a lot about protests in Northern Ireland, as you can imagine. Left in 2014, went to work in technology at Openreach, so I'm the reason why everyone's broadband is awful, and I could also tell you why your broadband's terrible too. And then for the last 5 or 6 years, I've done various corporate social responsibility roles, and in between that, I attempted and failed miserably at becoming a politician. I tried to become a Conservative MP, shocking for the podcast. I tried to become a Conservative MP. And interestingly, I, for today's subject, topic as well, about defence later, I was going to be the candidate to run against Jeremy Corbyn in his constituency. Mm-hmm. But I was not chosen. That was 2017. I was not chosen because I wrote a thing for Conservative Home saying we should get rid of nuclear weapons.
Oh, wow.
And they decided I was too risky because, you know, Corbyn being all against nuclear weapons, like it would have been a big problem. But then I left the party and tried to run as an MEP for Change UK, and that was a wonderful week while everyone cared about Change UK. And then
lovely.
No one talked about that anymore. Nick,
do you deliberately... What is your policy for disclosing your previous Tory credentials on dating apps and the like?
Well, I don't tend to date people from Britain, so it's not normally a problem.
Excellent. Well, very, very good. At least you found a workaround. So as Nick...
I mean, I think that raises more questions than it does answers, frankly. But
No. I'm trying desperately for us to continue with the actual format of the podcast.
Yes, when we do the dating podcast, I'm more than happy to answer that question.
Excellent.
Further.
It'll be an incredibly successful spin-off, I'm sure. So as Jimmy has said, we are going to first of all be talking about the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, we have to protest very quietly. We're then going to be talking about the integrated review for security, defence, development and foreign policy from the government as well, where Nick's credentials are going to come in very handy, we think. And especially he's talking about nuclear weapons, actually.
Yeah.
And then finally... looks like your summer holidays to go off to the Costa del Sol are buggered. So we're going to talk about the fact that your ability to travel abroad may be a little bit in jeopardy at the moment. Just to say as well, there is a glaring omission from our topics this week, and that is the horrible death of Sir Everard, who was obviously murdered in walking home through Clapham a couple of weeks ago. We have decided to pause that because the case is ongoing, but will likely... Well, I mean, we will talk about it in the future. And also when we have somebody who isn't a man to talk about it as well, probably. Okay, shall we move on with the show, gentlemen?
Let's play some music, tell them about the Patreon account, and as Jazza said, get on with the show.
Excellent. Well done, everyone.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jazza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/JazzaInChina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show. Jazza, I feel you're a relatively big fan of protests. You've definitely attended more than me as an active participant rather than an observer. So this bill really is targeted directly towards your sort of people, you know, the troublemakers and rabble-rousers out there. Do you feel personally, you know, targeted by this? Is this going to disrupt your political activism going forward?
Personally targeted. I'm not sure that Jazza John is mentioned in paragraph 3 subsection F or whatever in this bill, but it's certainly bloody worrying, isn't it? So the thing that I am worried about is the ambiguity around what constitutes something that is going to be able to be moved on by the police when there is a specifically a static protest. So they're going to be able to move on protests that are static whenever they like. They're also going to be able to disperse them and make arrests based on inconvenience and also based on noise. If you have ever been to a protest, you will know that there is often noise, and often the goal is inconvenience, actually. And a lot of the justification of these, frankly, they are authoritarian. They're proposing more authoritarian rules around the right to assembly, have been justified by, oh, this is just about people gluing themselves to railings and jumping up and down on train cars, for example. And... like, as if that's okay. They're, like, invoking the climate change protest that we had a couple of years ago.
Extinction Rebellion, specifically.
Extinction Rebellion protests, which are, like, extreme and did cause inconvenience, but that is the point of a protest.
Right, so... just putting my sort of Tory hat on for a second, as they're the ones putting...
Well, we've got
bill.
An actual Tory in the room, Jimmy. You don't need to be...
Former Tory.
Former. Yeah, which one... Actually, I'm confused as to who is who now. Things have shifted around the last year so much. I don't know who I
right,
am or
exactly.
What you are anymore.
I'll tell you what, actually, Nick, you know, as a former Tory candidate, you presumably feel some sympathy with the sort of conservative suspicion, I guess, of protest or scepticism towards it. And you outlined that a little bit in the introduction to this. So what's your take on this bill? Do you think it's a fair, proportionate crackdown on
protests? No, I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's fair at all. I think it's... I mean, I'll stand by my views that the Conservative Party of now is not the Conservative Party of 3 or 4 years. Of pre-Brexit time, I think it's shifted significantly. Those of you outside it might not agree, but those of us who were inside it see it slightly different, maybe. I don't think it's proportionate. I think it comes from a bit of a weirder obsession with protecting statues over freedoms and rights. And I think it's a terrible step in the direction it goes.
Just to jump in on that, there is maximum sentence. Obviously, this is maximum sentencing, but there's maximum sentencing of up to 10 years for defacing a public statue.
Memorial specifically, so it would have to be commemoration of war dead or something like that. Sure. It's not just any statue.
Sure, but a memorial could be any dead person really could be classified as a memorial, couldn't it?
I think there's a specific definition I could be wrong.
Sure.
10 years is a lot anyway.
But it was, especially off of the back of the Sarah Everard case, a lot of the framing that especially Labour did was that you could get twice the amount of time for spray painting Churchill's statue than you do for raping a woman or raping somebody. And that does seem a little bit crazy.
I think that's also inaccurate in a sense. I think it's because the minimum sentence for rape is 5 years.
Yes.
But that is a minimum. People do go away for life for rape.
Yes,
rarely.
Well, rarely because it's a very difficult crime to prosecute.
I think also that you're saying with the same issue with putting potential 10 years in jail for defacing a statue means that if someone did do it, the jury is more likely to kind of go, well, is this really going to be a proportionate sort of punishment? So I don't think that's ever going to get used. But the question is, why is it such an extreme amount of time for a statue? And I, as someone who feels very strongly about remembering war dead and memorials from my service in the army, but the other thing most soldiers will tell you is that we, sacrifice our time and lives and, physical fitness and health so people can be free and protest. And so I find it distasteful the government uses this lever.
Yeah, and there's also quite a lot of the stuff that they are saying that they're trying to combat with this bill. It's already illegal. Destruction of public property, for example, is still something that you can be prosecuted for. There is still, if, for example, you're blocking emergency services, for example, which was one of the examples that was brought up in Parliament when this was being debated on its first reading, where an ambulance wasn't able to get to, I believe it was St. Thomas's Hospital, because of a protest in Parliament Square. Those things are already illegal, and people were prosecuted for those things. And there doesn't seem to me to really be a need to broaden this. I think that the mask slipped. Maybe I'm. Am I deliberately painting them as sinister by saying they're wearing masks? Yes, I am. But there was this was reported very well on Politics UK from a commentary piece by Ian Dunt, who quoted one of the Tory MPs who had a contribution to making the House, who said, I'm going to put on a Tory voice for a second. Hold on.
I can't wait to hear this, by the way.
No, wait. Really okay.
Isn't that just your normal voice, Jazza?
You can fuck right off. I am a public school boy who went to Oxford, so I am part of the problem. I'm not blind to that. But my voice, my office looks onto Parliament Square, and I have long complained about the endless demonstrations that take place. It is very difficult to work because of the noise, with drums and horns and loudspeakers. Parliament being the seat of democracy, our work should not be disrupted. Which kind of... That's the point of having a protest on Parliament Square, is so that the work is disrupted, and so that you cannot ignore the thing that the people are protesting. And by you, I mean the people who are making the laws and legislating. And just because Mr. Amos's work is somewhat disrupted, oh, heaven forbid, he might have to buy some noise-cancelling headphones.
So there are... I have to challenge on a couple of those things, Jazza.
Go on, no, go for it.
Jimmy's going to start smiling now, because actually I'm going to agree with you there. I'm going to go sort of change sides slightly. The experience of some of the MPs, but also the support, most importantly, the support staff, and a lot of female MPs have come under a lot of abuse from people as they walk from the tube to the Houses of Parliament. And I know you don't think that's fair. I'm not suggesting in any way you would think that was. But I think there are fair measures that could be put in place to ensure that staff and MPs, as they're walking in, do not get abused. Protested, absolutely fair one. You know, waving your banners, banging your drums, completely agree with you. But from a safe distance, it's not... I mean, you saw some of the Brexit demonstrations.
Are you talking about the Anna Soubry harassment that took place?
That's one example. I think Jess Phillips has talked about it. Jacob Rees-Mogg and his kids got abused. Now, I don't particularly like Jacob Rees-Mogg, but I don't want to see him being abused.
We've covered the full political spectrum there. Jacob Rees-Mogg, Jess Phillips, and Anna Soubry. Yeah. Excellent. All of them.
Yeah. And we have to ensure people can protest, but protest within reasonable, you know, being reasonable and that the actions aren't bad. You know, I'm not someone who thinks it's funny when Farage gets a milkshake to the face. You know, these sort of things are...
I mean, it is funny. I mean, no one's ready to put
it. I don't agree. I'm sorry. I've had this conversation. I'm not sorry at all. I do not agree. It's never funny because it's... All it does, it means that if it's acceptable to do to one person of one party, whether you like them or agree with them, means you can do it to absolutely anybody. And therefore, the line has to be very, very clear. And that's where
What do you think would be an appropriate kind of protest for that kind of thing, though? Like, is it because it's a milkshake? Like, would a glitter bomb be appropriate?
No,
Well, it is assault at the end of the day. You're, you know, physically...
No, it's a glitter, not assault.
Life.
I am very funny.
I think it depends on the context, but generally I would prefer people to avoid physical transgressions and also getting in people's face and being verbally abusive.
Yeah, I think it is hard to know where to draw the line because, you know, where it is sort of right that people can say rude things about politicians, but then if you're like surrounding somebody like a pack in the streets and shouting at them, that looks, I mean, it looks terrible for one reason, but it is also physically threatening or can be to the person who's being assailed. So I think it's a hard thing to draw the line. But, you know, there are rules around harassment and there are already restrictions around protest. I mean, as we saw with the Sarah Everard vigil that Jazza referenced earlier on, you know, initially people tried to organize a vigil in cooperation with the police. There ended up being a court case where the court said to them, you know, you guys need to sort it out among yourselves, i.e. the organizers and the police need to decide. Eventually the organizers pulled out, but it went ahead anyway, sort of an unofficial basis. But there are already restrictions around this, I guess. And I don't get the impression that, like, it was actually, you know, a huge problem before. I mean, obviously, the Extinction Rebellion protests were disruptive and some people did go over the line, like Jazza referenced, the guy who jumped on the train. So, you know, there are people that take it too far, but that's always going to be the case, right? And the law is there to decide when it has gone too far and hand out appropriate punishments.
What do you think is the genesis? Why are they doing this then? We've kind of collectively decided that this bill is bad and I want to avoid this being an echo chamber. Yeah. Why are they doing this?
I think the Extinction Rebellion context is there. I think I guess also the memorial thing and the stat. I mean, this is part of a wider police and crime bill, so there's a whole raft of measures that we haven't actually touched on to do with sentencing and other things. This is just the protest part that is particularly salient because of the activity around the vigil for Sarah Everard. I think it is the memorial thing and the culture war thing. You know, the Tories have been very big on saying, you know, we don't want you know, protesters defacing our statues of our national heroes and that kind of thing, and I think it was designed to look tough around that, but I don't really get the impression it was necessary from a, you know, societal order point of view.
It goes down well with their base, I think, as Jimmy says. Yeah. You know, it's a nice populist move. The core Tory voters love it. You know, if you're an over 50 white guy, brilliant. You get to crack down on all these hippies in London. It's very much against inner city areas, which are traditionally more socialist, liberal, Labour voters. And so it's a great thing for the, you know, Tory base.
I will say one thing that is interesting is obviously, you know, there've been a couple of major sort of protest threads throughout the lockdown period. There've been the Black Lives Matter protesters. There's also been the lockdown skeptics, who actually, I think there were a couple of thousand of them in London yesterday. Well, one thing that is interesting to me is when the anti-lockdown protesters were out and about, there seemed to be this sort of swell of skepticism towards them and saying, like, how can you protest, you know, lockdown, you know, given all these measures to protect public health and stuff. And it does seem to me that people tend to be quite partial in, you know, what they're willing to criticise with protests, like, you know, people saying, okay, fine, you can protest in favour of Black Lives Matter, but you can't, you know, the same people were quite sceptical about anti-lockdown protests. And I think, as Nick said at the start of this conversation, you have to be equal in your treatment of this. You have to protect protests, whatever it is they're protesting in favour or against of, basically.
The only places that I end up seeing that are by disingenuous partisan papers, generally, like The Spectator, for example, or even The Guardian, for example, like, to take two extremes.
I don't think it's unique to any particular group. I think, you know, in politics, but see people applying different standards, right, depending on whether they're for or against.
Yeah, but generally, from people who don't kind of like have a set agenda, and even on my Twitter feed, to be completely honest, I've never seen anybody say that people shouldn't have the right to protest lockdown. I've only seen people say these people are idiots for protesting lockdown, and that is a very different
thing. I mean, interestingly, Jazz, actually, it's funny you should say that, because when there was the anti-lockdown protest last year, and I think it was Piers Corbyn who got, I can't remember if he was charged, but I remember they tried to fine him something stupid like £10,000, an obscene amount of money. And actually, what was interesting was all of the sort of very right-wing newspapers I expected to be critical of the protest actually were very critical of the government. And their view was, you know, this is almost authoritarian. I think mainly because they generally believe that we shouldn't be locked down. So they were positive of the anti-lockdown protest. But their point was fair, which is that the response by the government to the anti-lockdown protesters, who were very peaceful, was that they were going to sort of arrest them all and charge them a huge amount of money with no legal recourse to say this is unfair. I don't know what happened in the end. I'm pretty sure he didn't pay. I'm sure he went back and said, I don't think this is a reasonable fine. But yeah, it was amazing to see the response, which was that actually these protests should have been allowed to go ahead and the government's acting unfairly. So I don't know if this bill is as popular as the Tories necessarily think it's going to be.
Well, one thing that is interesting is there was definitely some polling around the Sarah Everard vigil, and I keep sort of coming back to it, but it was the political context for this bill being debated in Parliament. And actually, I think the majority of people felt that the vigil shouldn't have taken place because it was, you know, it was seen as a kind of political protest and seen as unnecessary. I think during the course of lockdown, there has been a fairly widespread feeling that protests should be restricted in some way. I know there's been other people on the argument that said, you know, protest is one of the things you have to allow during lockdown because it's about fundamental democratic freedoms. But I think probably this, I mean, authoritarian, you know, sort of bills are often quite popular, even in Western democracies, you know, cracking down on behaviour that people see as disruptive or, you know, out of order.
It's kind of actually a case for, and I was thinking about this, like, what is the safeguard against these kinds of populist policies and bills and changes to our democratic freedoms? And really annoyingly, it comes back to us having some kind of a codified constitution. And I don't want that. I don't think, because I like the fluidity of kind of like the fluid state of the British constitution, in that it doesn't really exist, but also it exists everywhere at once.
It's like Schrodinger's constitution.
Schrodinger's constitution. It exists and doesn't exist at the same time.
Don't look at it. Don't open the box because you'll find out. It's
but yeah, it's like, I feel like that's the only thing that is the real surefire safeguard against that, these kinds of things. Otherwise, you are going to end up with these swings towards populism whenever the winds allow for it. Speaking about swings to populism, we love big guns blowing things up. Bang, 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 military, bang.
I like big guns and I cannot lie. Don't. The other brothers can't deny.
No, don't start sick. Stop it. Nick, don't do that. So this integrated review, the Integrated Review for Security, Defence, Development and Foreign Policy, it's a bloody mouthful, isn't it?
It is a mouthful, yeah.
Jimmy, you've written a little bit on the website about some of the key takeaways of this, specifically with the Big Bang car things, tanks.
The Big Bang car things.
Mm-hmm. The armoured vehicle things was based on an inquiry from the Defence Committee, which basically concluded that the United Kingdom's armoured vehicle stock is really shite and really needs to be improved, which is something that Nick probably has intimate knowledge of, actually, given his career in the
army. They've been banging on about this for years. It was Fres, I think, was the programme I remember, and Fres has been banned in about 17 different times, so...
Yeah, so the context is the Ministry of Defence is often agreed to be quite shit at military procurement, which is a problem, I would say. But the integrated review we're sort of waiting on this Defence Command paper, which will sort of outline defence spending in a sort of more detailed way. The integrated review is really about the kind of overarching strategic posture of the UK. The big point I picked out about it, and this isn't that new a thread, but it actually sort of acknowledged that the kind of rule-based international order that emerged sort of post-Cold War up until roughly the present day is now sufficiently fragmented that we're now in a state of sort of competition between states over interest, norms and values, as the integrated review puts it. So there's just a widespread acknowledgement that liberal democracies need to consciously assume that everybody is marching in their general direction, and that there needs to be a more assertive way of actually asserting our interests and our values, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot...
The big bogeymen there are Russia and China, broadly, right? And there is a lot of talk about the shift within the review towards an Asia-Pacific, like spending more time in the Asia-Pacific region.
Yeah, although I should be, I could be interested to hear Nick's view on this, actually, because there is this tilt to the Indo-Pacific, which is the term the document uses, you know, most of our forces are still going to be committed to, and most of our focus is still going to be based in Europe and the Euro-Atlantic area for obvious reasons. And actually, I think you can overstate the Indo-Pacific tilt. It seems to be more a tilt of resources away from, say, areas like the Middle East and Afghanistan and that sort of thing towards, you know, the actual Pacific. That was what I got out of it. But I guess we should pass it over to Nick. Nick, what was your take of the integrated review?
I think it reflects I think it's a reflection of the government trying to turn its attention away from Western Europe in many, many ways. And seeing a political and trade opportunity in Asia and the Southern Hemisphere in the Pacific area more than we have had our relationships primarily being based in Western Europe. You know, they're talking about the trade pact, aren't they, as well? They want to join in the South Pacific, and which baffles me as to why they're even thinking about that, considering it's so far away. But yeah, that's essentially what they're trying to do, Jimmy, is that they're trying to turn their attention to what they see as the threats coming out of China and turning away from Western Europe quite so much.
Can I challenge that for a sec? Because wasn't this shift and pivot kind of already happening? And really, in the grand scheme of things, like, it's kind of framed as a reimagining of the UK's role post leaving the European Union. Mm. But actually, broadly, militarily, not a lot of stuff is changing for us. There's still a clear commitment to NATO. The shift towards Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific influence was already happening, really. Also with our allies from the States as well. Isn't this just kind of like they're just reframing it as it's part of the global Britain brand? But wasn't it already kind of happening anyway?
Yeah, and Britain's sort of secondary nature to following US defence strategy is part of this paper. You know, they do write very specifically the US remain our prime military
ally.
Mm. I said the ally. I wasn't say partner, but ally is the word I wanted. And that's still the case. And from the day I joined the army until the day I left until now, that's still the obsession Britain has been about. It thinks it's an equal partner militarily with the US. The US thinks of us as a nice chum to bring along to the party. And, you know, there are certain things that the US really values, actually, from the UK in terms of strategic capability. Nuclear deterrent is one of them. Special forces is another one. Britain's global presence is very important because Britain does have a huge global presence through its military in many different countries, you know, many of them Commonwealth. And the US relies on that and finds that a particularly important strategic asset. So that's why we align so closely to what the US, and the US did their tilt to the Pacific, I think, under Obama many years ago.
Yeah. When you talk about our global military presence, you're talking about the sort of military bases we have scattered around the world on various islands and that kind of
thing.
Yeah.
You know, Falkland Islands is one. You know, you've got Gibraltar as well. You've got places like Diego Garcia. Then you've got Ascension Islands. You know, these are really powerful strategic locations that are useful to the US.
You talked about our nuclear capabilities, Nick, and as you said in the intro, you famously wrote about how we should be moving towards a no nuclear world. For the first time since the Cold War, the UK is planning on increasing its nuclear arsenal and being a bit more sneaky, not going to tell you what's happening about how we report on them. Just a quick quiz, by the way, before we dive into the nuclear section of this topic.
Nuclear.
Who can name nuclear? Who can name all of the nuclear-capable countries in the world?
I'll let Nick have a go at this, I think.
Go on, Nick.
Okay. Well, China.
Uh-huh.
Russia.
Yeah.
United Kingdom.
Yeah.
United States.
Yeah.
France.
Yeah.
India.
Yeah.
Pakistan.
Yeah.
Israel.
Yeah.
North Korea.
Well, was that open on the screen for you? Are you cheating?
No, of course not. It's not open on the screen.
Can I be honest? I always forget that India and Pakistan have.
I would have forgotten those two for sure. Yeah,
They're the ones. They're the ones that keep me awake at night. If anyone's keep me awake at night when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's a mistake in Pakistan or India, because there's a lot of nationalism between and conflict between the two. So it's
Which obviously had absolutely nothing to do with any lines that were drawn in sand by the United Kingdom. The UK currently has reported, anyway, 195 capacity for 195 nuclear warheads, and is going to increase that to, was it 260?
260, yeah.
Where it was originally going to be going down to 180. This is the first shift upwards that we've ever had. And we had this morning, we're recording this on Sunday, we had the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace on the Andrew Marr programme, who in a very strange roundabout way basically said, we don't have, our nuclear deterrent is not powerful enough at the moment for it to be a deterrent, and so that's why we're increasing it.
Well, that can be the only logic behind it, right? Is that it's implied that if you're upping the numbers, you don't think the current numbers are adequate in some stage.
Mm-hmm. But surely 195 is enough to blow any fucking country off the map, right?
I think it's a really odd argument, frankly. Any one of these devices is enough to do extraordinary. I mean, they're much bigger than the Hiroshima bombs that we always do the comparisons with. I think they're 50 kiloton bombs, aren't they? 50 kiloton bombs?
Oh, you're asking me. When you get into numbers with those many zeros, it's...
I can't remember. I was reading it because I know we use the same warheads as the US, and the US are planning on replacing their warheads at some point, and there's been discussion about it, and we're basically lobbying them to replace them with more powerful warheads. So not only will we have more, they'll also be more powerful. So it's absolute rubbish. There's no need to. I think my understanding is that they need to increase the numbers because it's a transition. They're replacing, they'll go up in number and then they'll go back down because, you know. But the current devices are very old. I think they're from the 70s, so it just makes sense they need to be replaced.
But I was reading a piece from the Rossi think tank, which is sort of the main defence think tank in the UK, and they were saying if it was a temporary sort of changeover where you, as you say, you increase the numbers while you're doing the replacement, then you bring them back down once the replacement programme is finished, you could frame it in that way. You could say, we're not departing from our commitments to, you know, non-nuclear proliferation. This is just a temporary expedient while we do a changeover. And they deliberately didn't do that. So that I think is kind of interesting in itself. What's your you sort of referenced this article you wrote where you argued against the UK maintaining its nuclear weapons program. What's your reasoning behind that?
I wrote this about 5 years ago now. My main argument, well, there's two reasons. One, it's an extraordinarily large amount of money for something that a lot of other first world nations have, just Germany, you know. Japan decided that they don't need nuclear weapons.
I don't think they did. I don't think they decided that. I think
that was the Americans. They
still have. If they decide to create them now, much if North Korea, India, and Pakistan can do that, they could certainly decide to do it. But they live under the American umbrella. But there's a lot of countries in the world that decide they don't need it, and they operate fine without it. And I question the logic. But the second reason, which I think was more about the strategic use of it, was that they are useless devices. No one can use them without killing ourselves. So I get it, mutually assured destruction, that's the strategy. But the weapons of the future, and we've seen this over the last 5 years, are things like cyber warfare, online warfare, media, news manipulation, hacking. These are the technologies far more damaging. I mean, people are going to do far more damage and use them without destroying themselves, the nuclear weapons that ever could. And I think that if we took that money and invested it in cyber warfare, we would have the ability to defend ourselves brilliantly. I worry about things like, and I'm getting to Dominic Cummings' danger territory now, I worry more about things like nano-robot warfare, right? That terrifies me more than nuclear warfare, because these, you know, tiny machines that can be developed, that can be deployed like viruses to go and do specific damage to individuals, targeting people's DNA, selectively, you know, eliminating people with certain traits. This is the sort of warfare that is coming over the next 5-10 years. And nuclear weapons are just going to remain in their silos in the subs, utterly useless, but £37 billion down. I think it's bonkers. And the decision to move forward with the strategic review in this way demonstrates that the UK defence community is still stuck in the past. Big ships, lots of planes, big bombs, big tanks, love it. But what do we need in the future? Stuff that can defend us from nanorobots, because that's where the danger is going
to
be.
So to be fair to the Integrated Review, it does have some fairly extensive discussion about, you know, science and technology investment. There's also stuff about sort of building up an industrial base for us to be able to, you know, deliver that technology and actually use that technology. But I do, something that I do kind of agree with you on is that there doesn't seem to be much sense of priority, I think, reading the, I've only read the sort of introductory and overview sections of this, but it's not like they're saying, you know, Britain is going to specialise in these particular types of warfare. There still seems to be a commitment to doing a bit of everything, which I think is strange, considering that we're kind of widely acknowledged to be a medium-sized power at this stage. You know, you might say top-tier medium-sized power, but it doesn't make much sense that we're doing everything, and you know, the nuclear piece is part of that. I think I don't know what advantage we get from having our own nukes compared to relying on America to, you know, have a nuclear program to deter Russia and China. Do you know what I mean?
I think about priority is really important, because I think if we look at the national security strategy, I'm pretty sure one of the top threats to the UK was pandemic. And what clearly have demonstrated the last year was that we were wholly and utterly, totally unprepared for a pandemic. And I'm pretty sure climate change is in there as well in the national security strategy.
Yeah, it's definitely mentioned in the
as some of the very top risks. And so you're sat there going, these are your priorities, these are your highest risks, let's build nuclear weapons.
But if we nuked coronavirus, then it would have been fine. Then we would have been fine. There would have been nothing. Guys, you're also missing what I think is the most important part of this defence review. Can you guess what it is, what I'm thinking about? A 14-year-old Jazzer is having a lovely time in his head.
I mean, the mind boggles, I think.
Is there a Rainbow Squadron? I don't know.
Oh my god, if only there was a Rainbow Squadron. But it is United Kingdom Space Command, which sounds so much like the fucking Thunderbirds that I am so on board. It used to be called like Integrated Command or something really boring like that. But now, because the UK is going to have to launch its own satellites and shit, we have a UK Space Command, and they're going to be launching UK satellites from Scotland.
It's going to be so bad, isn't it? It's going to be more expensive and worse than everything else before it.
UK Space Command, like, you can imagine, like, the jumpsuits and the logo. I love the logo already. It's probably got a Union Jack and a star, a shooting star, maybe. Oh, it's going to be
great. Oh, my God. Oh, goodness save me. I do think it's interesting they've set up a Ranger Brigade. I don't know if you saw that.
It's like they've Super set up a Ranger Brigade. Right?
Well, yeah, so I can't figure this one out. Jim, I don't know if you've seen it and why. Because it said it's supposed to do some of the stuff that the SAS and SBS do. And this is actually good because this is really common. Whereas the SAS and SBS get sent off to do high-end military activity that they weren't really designed for because they're just really excellent soldiers. And what they're supposed to be used for is very specific activities. They've been used as more general sort of, vanguard troops rather than special troops like the forces that they're supposed to be used for. So they've created this Ranger Brigade. It's a huge unit. I mean, it's 4,000 odd people, 2,000 to 4,000 people. So it's very large. And it's particularly consisting, it's going to be almost 10% of the army, I think, by, you know, well, maybe 5%. But there's already the Special Forces Support Group. So I'm not sure if the SFSG is wrapping up and becoming this Ranger Brigade. But the Special Forces Support Group was set up specifically to support the Special Forces anyway, of which they already created the Special Reconnaissance Regiment. So it seems like there's a belief that the army is going to become ever more elitist and ever more sort of specialised, but smaller. Because, I mean, 4,000 people is about as many as they sent to Afghanistan the first
time. There was also a lack of, from the conversation that happened with the Defence Secretary this morning on Andrew Marr, he also didn't commit to not reducing the number of troops in the army. So and Andrew Marr said, well, every time that I've ever asked a defense secretary that in all his years of broadcast, they've never said that they would reduce their numbers. The fact that he didn't commit to it is interesting.
I think if you follow Nick's argument, though, you know, we're going to be seeing more warfare that is, you know, drones, to use that word, the nanobots maybe in the far-flung future, cyber warfare.
Nanobots.
And all of that kind of thing. I don't, you know, the whole argument about, like, how many personnel we have in the armed forces seems to me to be a bit redundant, really. I mean, what matters is not raw numbers, not raw manpower, it's what we're doing with it and, you know, how much we're spending on technology and how that technology is used. And it's part of a whole conversation, do you know what I mean? So I know, you know, it sort of like gets the, you know, the Daily Express's blood boiling whenever we cut, you know, the manpower of our armed forces. But I don't really see that it's a bad thing per se. Do you know what I mean? And actually, the UK government is spending more on our armed forces in general terms. So I don't see what the problem is personally on that front.
Yeah, I do agree with Jimmy. I understand what he's saying. I think it's a fair argument. It depends the type of warfare that we're going to be fighting. I'm deeply concerned about the use of drones in warfare when targeting people. I have an issue with robots targeting humans. I have an issue with people flying from California on a computer screen and blowing someone up in Pakistan with a bomb, knowing the amount of collateral damage. And I think there's a moral, fundamental moral problem with that, and these types of warfares don't seem to solve anything. Now, if you're talking about fighting a peer adversary, you know, if we're going to war with another country with drones and tanks and proper soldiers, not insurgents, yes, I have no issue there whatsoever. It's about strike capability. So it depends on the war we're fighting. There are moral and ethical questions I don't think we address particularly well. So I think there's a lot more to come out of this review yet to answer all these questions.
Mm. Well, we have been talking about this for 20 minutes now, so maybe we should turn to summer holidays instead. Jazzy, you're a sort of metropolitan jet-setting Ramona type, always, you know, going off to far-flung climes to, you know, enjoy a bit of the sun. The government's announcement that holidays are extremely unlikely, I say governments, it's a member of the government's Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on modelling, which is quite a mouthful, has said that overseas holidays are extremely unlikely this summer. This must have been devastating news for you, I'd imagine.
I mean, I just want to clarify one mischaracterization that you have there, and that's I hate the sun. So I generally holiday places that are suitably cold, overcast, and more about activity and culture than they are about lying on a beach. Thank you very much, Jimmy. That said, yeah, I am a little bit worried because I was planning on going... I was planning on doing a European road trip this summer, and it looks like that may not happen. Yeah, I'm a little bit annoyed, but also you've got to make sure that we're on top of the pandemic, haven't you? And especially within the EU, it is not looking fantastic in terms of the amount of vaccinations that are going into people's arms, and some of the countries just starting to have pretty bad third waves. We had our third wave at the end of last year, really, going into the beginning of January, and France and Germany are just, well, Germany much less so, to be fair, because they aren't incompetent. But France especially is having a particularly bad third wave at the moment, is having, I think, nearly as many daily infections as the US is. And when you compare, that's absolute numbers rather than percentages. And so when you compare population size, that's a pretty big deal. But also you shouldn't have fucking booked a holiday that you couldn't cancel in the first place, you bloody idiot. Just go to Kent.
Don't go to Kent. That's where things started. That's where the bad thing is.
That's a fair point. Okay. Wadebridge. I don't know. That's in Kent as well, isn't it? Oh shit. Wales. There's no Welsh variant, is there?
Not yet. No.
There will be if we all go to Wales though.
Yeah. Fun times. But yeah, it sucks, but it makes sense.
Actually, I'm really glad they've been honest about it. I think I'm so glad they've come out and said it, because it was so obvious from a mile away what was going to happen. And it's about time that some realism came out of these advisory groups on what life is going to be like next. We had this last year, you know, we locked down from this, I think from today, wasn't it? Isn't it a year today or is it a year this weekend, isn't it?
Something like that.
It's a year next week, yeah.
And we were all told the lockdown for 3 weeks will be reviewed and everyone thought it'll be a month. And then all of a sudden, 4.5 months later, we sort of stepped out sniffing the air in June or July or whenever it was to go and explore some stuff. And quite quickly, numbers went up and lockdowns set up and if there's the feeling again now is that it's all over, it's all done, we've had our vaccines and everything's fine. And it's not true. You know, we could see cases going up again worldwide. Brazil's having its worst cases ever still now, getting worse. India's going back up again. Europe looks terrible. I'm glad there's some honesty and reality coming out now from the government advisory groups and the government about holidays. It's about time.
Okay. So no one seems to disagree that this is a smart measure then. Like, however upsetting it might be for our personal holiday plans.
It's a nice juxtaposition to how it was handled, maybe, how summer holidays were handled last year, where they just kind of, like, put it off, never told any... Like, implied that you were going to still be able to... Oh, it'll be over by summer, etc. People still booked holidays. Ryanair and EasyJet were still kind of, like, emailing you every day, going, being like, now is the time to book your holiday. And it was... like that, people were able to capitalize on that hope of being able to get away, and it just wasn't realistic.
You could still fly though, couldn't you? You could still get out if you wanted to go in the middle, you know, because flights were still happening.
You could go there,
go on holiday, come back, and they say self isolate, but nobody, no one, I think nobody was fined. For not complying, yeah.
Oh, do we know that? I don't know.
I'm sure it's in the news, but it certainly wasn't many people if there were.
But I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast yet, but when I was coming back from Portugal, when I was visiting my brother, I think just before we went into lockdown in November, before Christmas again, there was a lady on the plane who, as soon as we touched down in Heathrow, got on the phone, started, pulled down her mask, started talking very loudly, saying about how, oh yeah, don't worry, I'll come over day after tomorrow to she wasn't a Cockney, I don't know why I've given her this voice. She's quite posh actually. She was like, oh, I'll come over to the day after tomorrow, I hope nobody catches me, obviously meant to be out. And I was just like, what a cunt, what a selfish twat. And I can guarantee that was a large number of people. But I still don't really know what those restrictions look like. Track and trace is still an absolute mess.
Is that still a thing? I've not heard about that for ages.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know someone who's working on it. And apparently it's a lot better than it was before. But it's still an absolute shit show.
Yeah.
There was a load of stuff from... there was a report saying that it was just a money sink that came out last
week. Oh, it's just gone to a load of consultants charging $7,000 a day. You know, there's a huge amount of cronyism there, but... yeah, the system's not very good there. We've only just brought in the quarantine hotels. It was a couple of months ago. I mean, only the pandemic began on for a year, so we only just need to get ourselves some quarantine hotels, like New Zealand and Australia, who's managed to pretty much wipe out the virus in their country.
How does this affect your boys' well-being, frankly? If you are going to have to do staycations for the next couple of years, maybe... because it is a possibility. Hmm. How would that affect you?
It doesn't bother me.
I think it's okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite as enthusiastic as Jazza is about foreign
travel. I hate it so much. It is it's an affront on... like genuinely, I'm not going to be able to deal with it. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to deal with it properly. I think I would probably just up sticks and move somewhere just so that I could get out of the fucking East End.
Jazza, what do you think though? I mean, if they're already warning about holidays, do you think things like festivals are realistically going to go ahead in the UK? Because I just can't see it, because they're
but
already
it's the,
now
it's
warning
the
people.
International, it's the international aspect of it that I think is the thing that they are scared of, and it's stuff like the picking up of new variants and allowing that spread.
Yeah, they've
I think they're trying to keep. Yeah, it's from what I understand from the advice given, the ability to keep it self-contained is the main issue there, and I mean I've bought a couple of club and festival tickets for the summer. I can't wait to attend and then very quickly realize why I hate clubs and festivals, but you know what, I've just been gagging for that experience again. I kind of fully expect like July, August to be very similar to our old July and August, but probably with less international travel, to be honest, because of the fear of new variants. Especially the South Africa one seems to be freaking everybody out because we don't have any confirmations as to whether or not the vaccines defend against it.
I think they're worried about what I've been calling the double Brazil, basically the Brazilian one, because of the rates over in Brazil are so high now. They're probably going to see a further variant from this already worrying Brazilian variant. Which will be even more deadly or even more transmissible or able to get around the vaccine. So, yeah, you're certainly correct. These variants. I mean, I think they were saying that a lot of our cases last year were linked back from people coming back from Spain when one of these sort of first variants came through that was more transmissible came from Spain. Well done, Spain.
I don't think it was Spain's fault. I think it was the people coming who decided to go there and come back. Don't you? Wasn't the nation of Spain?
Yeah, a little bit column A, a little bit column B. Yeah,
well, Portugal and Greece are like Brits. You can come here in May, and it's just like they're tourist nations. They need Brits' money because Brits are bigger spenders on holidays. Because most of them are weird.
Is it not Germany actually? Especially in Portugal, Germany are the largest.
Is it Portugal? Spain, I think it's Brits, but maybe Portugal is Germans. But yeah, Germans again, yeah. But they need British people too. Even though they hate them when they get there, they're just like they begrudgingly take their money.
To be fair, to be fair, have you seen English people in Portugal?
Yes,
it's thoroughly embarrassing.
I see English people in England and it embarrasses me. So yeah,
great. Well, on that anti-UK
converged
note.
On an anti-British note here from the two remainers on the podcast.
Oh, come on. Let it go. You won.
Go on. We'll give you 30 seconds, Jimmy, to say whatever you want that's pro-UK. Go on.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with you. I'm just, you know, pointing it out.
You should talk about flags, Jimmy. Everyone's banging on about flags at the moment, aren't they? So, or is when I was in Northern Ireland, we used to call it flags.
Great. That was An odd accent. Nick, if people want to get to know more about you, where can they find you?
Well, not many places, because I've deactivated my Twitter and no one wants to know.
Oh, you as well.
He's so, joining the abstinence. Joining the
I would say...
It's just going to be me and Jack from Twitter in a very short amount of time.
Who was that person on Facebook who was all in MySpace? Was it Tom on MySpace?
Tom from MySpace. He sold his shares, became a multimillionaire, and now is a photographer on Instagram.
Is he really?
Yeah, you can follow him on Instagram. Good lad. Good for him.
Good on him. Good on him. They can Google me and read about old stuff on Cook Conservative Home. There you go. That's what they can do.
Oh, excellent. Jimmy, where can they find you?
They actually can find me on Twitter at JDE Nichols.
Oh, you're officially back now?
Oh, no. I'm still just posting links to, stuff. I'm no longer engaging. Jazza, where can they find you, as you're a good internet boy?
You can find me on all social media platforms as Jazza John, because I am, as Jimmy said, a good internet boy.
Do you have your own? You've got your OnlyFans set up now, then, as well.
You know what? If I were able to have an OnlyFans, I probably would have an OnlyFans. But I like. There's only so much that Dad Bod can really build an audience. Do you know what I mean?
We'll sort that out.
So there's a market for everything on the internet, Jazza. So mm-hmm. Don't you worry. You should put yourself out there.
Great. Occupy that niche
at jazzadadbod.com.
if anybody makes that, I will personally destroy you. Okay, let's go now. Bye bye.